Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm Chris Gambino, your host for the channel. Today we'll be talking to Nicolette Hahn-Nyman about her book, Defending Beef, The Ecological and Nutritional Case for Meat, Revised and Expanded Edition. Nicolette, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Right now, I live on a ranch in Northern California, a little bit north of San Francisco. I was originally from the Midwest, from Michigan, and I studied biology undergrad and got a law degree from University of Michigan. And then I became a practicing attorney for a number of years. And I was a practicing attorney for 10 years. And the last several years, I was working for environmental groups and mostly focused on water pollution. But the second organization I worked for was called Waterkeeper Alliance, and I worked for Bobby Kennedy Jr. And he asked me to focus specifically on pollution from livestock production. So that sort of became my area of expertise. But as I headed up the project that he wanted me to work on, I sort of quickly decided that we needed to not just sort of, you know, focus on the problems of, you know, problematic systems, but also sort of highlight good examples of animal husbandry that was environmentally, sound and, producing good food and providing good lives for humans and animals. So we began working with a network of farmers called the Nyman Ranch Group, Nyman Ranch Company, which had several hundred farmers in it at that time. And through that, I was living in New York City working as an environmental lawyer. And I met Bill Nyman, the founder of Nyman Ranch, through the work. And I ended up marrying him and moving to California and to the ranch that he lived on. He's the founder of the Nyman Ranch Company and also a rancher himself. And when I first moved to the ranch, I was a vegetarian and an environmental lawyer and didn't have any intention of becoming a rancher myself, kind of, you know, an unusual background for a ranching person. And I ended up kind of falling in love with the ranch. And so for 7 years, I worked full time on our ranch. And then we have two young boys. And once they were born, I moved more to a part-time helper on the ranch. But I've been living on our ranch for the past 18 years and have spent a lot of time learning about, you know, sort of firsthand about how to do a good job of land stewardship and animal husbandry. And I've written two books and a lot of articles and essays about the topic of meat and how animals are raised for food, because my whole focus has become sort of advocating for, you know, improvements in how we're doing things, but at the same time, arguing that animals are valuable to ecosystems and to food systems, and that especially the food from those animals is extremely useful to human health, important, essential, actually, I would even say. So that's kind of become, you know, my focus over these last several years.
So you mentioned kind of how you got into the area, what brought you to the to kind of working on the topic, but this is the revised and expanded edition. So what prompted the update?
Yeah, I originally wrote the Defending Beef book about 6 years ago, and I had written it because my first book, Righteous Pork Chop, was really an argument against the kind of large-scale concentration of animal agriculture, and just arguing that, you know, that had a lot of problems for human and animal health, and for you know, for the environment, especially for water quality, but air quality as well. And after I wrote that book, I kept encountering people who said things like, "Well, I read your book and I became a vegetarian," or things like that. And I kept thinking, well, that wasn't really the point of it. You know, it was really trying to argue for better systems, you know, not eliminating animals from the food system or from our diets, but rather that we need to do things in a better way. And I particularly was frustrated by, you know, having not just spent a lot of time on our ranch here, but also having visited, I've probably visited well over 100 farms and ranches over the last 20 years, both in the U.S. and abroad. And I've seen a lot and I've learned a lot. And I really believe that the grazing animals in particular are incredibly important because of the way that they can tremendously benefit soil biology and use marginal lands, you know, lands that really can't be farmed or couldn't be, you know, the sources of food for humans otherwise. And so I just started thinking, you know, the grazing animals and especially beef, they're an incredibly important part of the food system, but there's just so much criticism of beef, you know, both, you know, on a health side and on an ecological side. And as someone who came, you know, has a very strong environmental background as an environmental lawyer, and, you know, I was even, you know, I would have called myself an environmentalist even as a child. I was, you know, I had the Ranger Rick, you know, magazine, and I spent a lot of time outdoors with my family, and I was always interested in the natural world. And I was, I am persuaded, and I was increasingly persuaded that the grazing animal plays a really important role in ecology and in the way that our, you know, our food systems, if we're trying to make them ecologically sound, we really need these animals. And so I felt a defense needed to be written, but by someone who both believed in beef and believed in the importance of, you know, really high standards from an ecological perspective. And so I wrote the original book, and I've done a lot of speaking and, you know, follow-up interviews and so forth from that book. But the publisher actually approached me and said, you know, we feel this topic is more, you know, more topical than ever. Would you be willing to update the book? And I jumped at the chance, and I thought I could do it in just a few months by adding some new research, because there's been a lot of research about the climate change issues and about soil biology and about on the human health side. So I thought I could probably just take a few months and, you know, add new research. But what ended up happening was I went through the book, you know, line by line over and over, and realized there was a lot that I wanted to change because I, you know, my thinking has evolved a lot and the situation has evolved a lot. So it's really a whole new book, and it's, I'm thrilled to have it coming out right now because there's so much anti-meat conversation out there. And I think most, you know, about 95% of it is completely wrongheaded. So I want to, you know, insert these ideas into the public dialogue that's taking place right now. That's very, you know, very suggestive that we should just stop eating meat altogether as humans, and that, you know, the food system really shouldn't have animals in it. So I was kind of excited to get the opportunity to redo the book. And this is really a whole new book, making the case both ecologically and nutritionally for the importance of cattle especially, but really all animals in the food system.
So let's jump in then. You've got this environment and culture section, and you talk a lot about kind of climate change, water, biodiversity, all these concepts that you just brought up that typically get wrestled with around the impacts of livestock production systems. And so let's go to climate change, right? That's one of the big ones that folks are talking about. That's probably why it's become a more salient conversation of late. You say that the charges of the climate change charges against cattle are like a red herring. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, I think for me, you know, as someone who grew up spending a lot of time outdoors and was always interested in nature and how it functions, increasingly I've become persuaded, you know, we just heard the results of the newest census saying that there are more, you know, we're a more urbanized population than ever in the United States. And that's true in most of the Western world as well, the industrialized world. And so, you know, I think part of what's happening is there's just more conversation being driven by people who don't spend much time out in nature and maybe aren't even interested in it, you know. I think it's a result of the sort of disconnectedness that people have from sort of, you know, living in the elements and in the seasons and really understanding on a very visceral level how nature works. Because for me, you know, with a biological background and an environmental background, I've become sort of more and more persuaded that, you know, the earth, how it evolved and how we as humans, how our bodies evolved, is kind of the fundamental starting point we should be talking about when we're trying to figure out, you know, how to do things in an ecologically sound way and what we should be eating to have, you know, healthy bodies. And when you think about it from that perspective, you know, the earth has had grazing animals, a lot of them, you know, for millions of years, for tens of millions of years. And the ruminant animal in particular had this incredibly important role in how the earth evolved in terms of sort of the creating and the maintenance of open grassy areas. So, you know, grasses evolved, you know, somewhere around 60 million years ago. And in the years following, there were more and more grazing animals evolving all over the world that were sort of creating large open grassy areas. And in fact, people often think that the earth was sort of covered in trees, you know, and until humans came and cut down the trees, especially like in Europe, a lot of people think that was the case. Well, in the US too, I hear that periodically when people are talking about, you know, environmental issues. And it's really a false perception because there was a long, you know, tens of millions of year history of the ruminant animal beginning to sort of exist in these open areas, and their presence and the presence of large populations of predators that were sort of keeping them, you know, keeping their populations in check, keeping them moving, etc. This was a huge part of how the earth evolved. So when we think about, you know, modern day food systems, there's a perception that underlies a lot of the conversation that animals are inherently problematic. And that, you know, I was just looking at an article just yesterday that was suggesting that, you know, the grazing animal is very quote unquote inefficient, you know, because it eats this, you know, very low quality of, you know, it has a very low quality diet in terms of what it's consuming when it's eating grass. And so therefore it takes up a lot of space. And this is, you know, translated. And this article was suggesting that because it takes up so much of the land mass of the earth and it produces, you know, a comparatively smaller percentage of the, you know, the nutrition for the earth, that therefore they're inefficient. Well, that's just, to me, that's just a fundamental misunderstanding about, you know, the role of the grazing animals. Because if you look at the earth, the long history of the earth, there were huge populations of grazing animals that declined, you know, quite a bit in recent, you know, millennia because of both the changes to the climate, but also human hunting reduced the population of wild grazing animals. But they've been here for a very, very long time. And the way I see the cattle in particular is kind of replacing those disappeared wild grazing animals that used to cover so much of the earth. And they can and should kind of play the same role from an ecological standpoint in terms of, you know, how they affect soil and vegetation and just the kind of, you know, upstream, you know, cascade that they have on an ecosystem. And when they're well managed, they do a very good job of replacing the disappeared wild grazing animal. So, for me, just the fundamental starting point in the discussion about grazing animals is quite off base. And then from a dietary standpoint, you know, as humans, we've been eating, you know, meat for probably around 3 million years. And all of our physiology is designed to have meat and other foods from animals as part of what we consume. And so when we talk about reducing animal-based foods or getting rid of them, we're basically making the argument that we can ignore our physiology and our, you know, our evolution, which I think is really a foolish approach.
So you keep bringing up the grazing animal. We'll come back to the grazing animal, but I think it's relevant because the book's Defending Beef is the title. And you just discussed kind of addressing the charges against cattle, but at the same time you say that there is a problem with methods of raising cattle. So maybe I'm jumping the gun, and once you answer this question, I won't have anything else to ask, but how do you distinguish the two? Essentially, you've got systems here that you're discussing, and one of them sounds like it's the grazing animal, but it's not just beef in general, right? You're not defending all beef in the book.
Yeah, well, to a degree, I am, because, you know, as I point out in the book, Wes Jackson, you know, who's a great sort of agricultural thinker, has argued that, you know, sort of the worst managed cattle ranch is probably ecologically more benign than a lot of crop production, you know. So I do like to make those kind of points. And also, even people, you know, most people who don't understand, you know, animal-based food systems very well, think of cattle as growing up and spending their whole lives in large feedlots and, you know, sort of never being on grass and never sort of providing the, you know, the kind of ecosystem services that they provide when they're on grass and they're well managed. But the reality is, of course, that cattle spend, you know, pretty much all cattle in the industrialized world will spend a good portion of their lives grazing. And, you know, the mother cows in a typical situation in the United States will spend pretty much their entire lives grazing. The calves will be with their mothers, and usually they'll continue to be on grass for a period of time after they're weaned, you know, until around, you know, typically till they're about a year old or so. And then they'll go to a feedlot. So, and then obviously the bulls also tend to be on grass for pretty much their entire lives. So when grazing is understood to be environmentally beneficial, and you understand that about cattle, it's a whole different conversation, you know. And then we can have debates about feedlots and whether they should exist at all or how they should be handled. You know, and I think I make it pretty clear in the book that I don't think that especially large feedlots are the best choice. I think that really all systems with grazing animals should maximize, including dairy systems, you know, should maximize how much time the animals are on grass. And I have to say that between the two books, you know, the first version of Defending Beef and the second version, I read a lot and learned a lot that convinced me more that it's more important than ever to have animals on grass, because there is actually a pretty convincing body of evidence that from a health perspective, you know, the food that you're producing, the meat or the milk, is benefited pretty significantly by having the animals on some sort of rangeland or pasture as much as possible. So I've shifted more towards the argument that we really should have them on grass as much as possible. That said, I understand the importance of the feedlot to the modern food system, and I don't, you know, totally condemn it and or people who use them, but I think that we should be moving, you know, collectively as, you know, as a society, we should be moving towards grass and away from feedlots. So I think, you know, to me, to go back to the climate change issue for a moment that you asked me about, I make the there's a lot of discussion of the science and the details in the book, but the sort of big picture argument is that, you know, the Earth had these grazing animals for millions of years. It's part of how the Earth is, it has evolved and is and functions. And what we really need to be doing is thinking about how do we use these animals in a way, how do we manage them and keep them in such a way that they're providing the ecological effects that they evolved with the Earth to do. And, you know, one of the most important things that they do, wherever you have well-managed grazing animals, their impacts, you know, their hooves press the vegetation and the seed into the soil, which feeds the soil and helps seeds to germinate. Their grazing eliminates, you know, when you have any area of grassland and you have grazing, you have more diversity of the plants because later sprouting plant varieties are and species are able to come up that would otherwise be crowded out by shade. And so there's more sunlight that hits all different types of, seeds and seedlings. And of course, their manure and their urine provides not just, we talk a lot about, you know, the sort of, the chemical components, you know, the nitrogen and other, potassium and phosphorus in manure and urine. But we don't always focus on the sort of the biological benefits that having the microorganisms that are in manure going back into the soil and how that can jumpstart the whole subterranean microorganism system that's below ground. So there are lots of reasons why having cattle or any grazing animals on a grassland will tend to not just sequester carbon, but will make the whole ecosystem more full of life and full of water. And there's a lot of evidence that there's more water kept in the soil and therefore the whole ecosystem gets more water when you have grazing animals. And so all of that has benefits for climate change because we know that more carbon is released to the air where you have desertified areas or dry areas. And wherever you have a vegetative cover that is, healthy and intact, but especially if it's diverse, you have more protection of the water that's in the soil, all of which keeps everything cooler. And there's more carbon going into the soil and more carbon staying in the soil coming from the atmosphere. So there are a lot of different ways in which grazing animals have a positive effect on an ecosystem from a climate change perspective. And there have been good studies in recent years, some smaller scale and some larger scale, showing that where you have good grazing that's well managed, you can actually have a net beneficial effect on climate because you'll have more carbon being sequestered in the soil than you will have that's being released by the whole production system. And so and that includes the methane, by the way. So that's a really important thing for people to understand as a starting point when we have that conversation about beef and climate change. And people will often come back and say, well, those are well-managed systems and most systems aren't well-managed. And I would give some credence to that point. But the point then is, okay, so then we need to focus on how we're raising the animals, right? It isn't the cow, it's the how. And that's definitely true for climate change, but it's also true for all of the other ecological issues that people bring up.
So I appreciate you kind of defending a little bit more about where your stance is. Recently, and in the past, a lot of the models suggest kind of the cow-calf aspect of the industry is where the majority of emissions reside, mainly because that's where the majority of the lifespan occurs. So where do we stand with kind of wrestling with kind of the whole system, right? If we're putting all the pieces together and you haven't yet said that you're outwardly against the feed yard or the feed lot. You do mention some problems that we'll get to at the end with regard to those that you want to transition the industry. But if we've got cow-calf, right, there's a lot going on. It's not just climate-oriented, right? You're looking at biodiversity, you're talking about soil, talking about water, all these things you mentioned. But from kind of the one metric that a lot of people use when they're having the conversation about whether or not to keep beef around is climate change, is greenhouse gas emissions. And yet a lot of the models say that the cow-calf sector, part of that supply chain, is the biggest emitter. How do we kind of combat that, or how do we have a discussion around that?
Well, it's all about the how. I mean, this is the whole thing, especially when you're, this is why I think there's a pretty important distinction between when cattle are on grass versus when they're in feedlots, because feedlots, you know, you will be bringing in feed. You know, you do have the animals, you know, essentially on dirt, and you bring the feed from some other location, and that feed has been harvested, you know, mechanically planted, harvested, transported, you know, so there is definitely going to be, you know, there are a number of different ways that you're going to have various ecological, you know, resource uses and effects from that. With grazing animals, when they're on grass, it's a totally different situation, because if they're, you know, there are tons of examples from around the world showing that where you have well-managed grazing, I mean, they're harvesting, you know, there isn't typically planting or, I mean, I'm pretty familiar with systems from around the world, and I know that there are places where there's a lot of, you know, usage of, you know, forage seeds, and where things are plowed and planted, and where things are irrigated, and where things are fertilized. And, you know, I know in New Zealand, they use a lot of fertilizer on grazing areas and so forth. And I've been to New Zealand and seen some of it for myself. But bottom line, if you're, you can create grazing systems where, so, you know, talking about the cow-calf portion, where you're not doing any of that, you know, where you're not having the environmental expenditure of using large-scale machinery or using agricultural chemicals, and you're really using the power of the grazing animal to create a healthy ecosystem and to do the foraging, to do the, you know, the harvesting of the plant themselves. And so it presents a pretty amazing opportunity. I mean, there really isn't any other type of food where we, you know, where that can, where it works like that. You know, there's pretty much going to be planting and harvesting and transporting with pretty much any other kind of food. So I think when you talk about the cow-calf section, and when you talk about that as being kind of the most problematic from a climate change perspective, it's all about the opportunity. You know, there's a tremendous opportunity to make that actually, because, you know, examples have shown this has been and can be done. That can be not just the most, you know, carbon neutral segment of the industry, but it can really be the part that provides all the ecosystem services that grazing animals can provide in terms of making more biodiverse environments. You know, there's some really good research that's been done, and I talk about it specifically in the book, showing that where you have more biodiversity in the soils, that you will have more biodiversity in the entire ecosystem. So everything becomes more biodiverse. You have more biodiversity of the plants, you have more biodiversity of the insect life, you have more biodiversity of the larger animals, you know, so it kind of goes from microorganisms all the way up to, you know, megafauna. And that kind of mind frame, you know, when you're thinking about that as being an important part of the way we approach food production, you can see how important the grazing animal is, because the grazing animal, when well managed, has tremendous beneficial effects in terms of the biodiversity of the life of the soil. And this is a little bit off the topic of your question, but I've been really intrigued by the work of Dr. Fred Provenza in showing that the biodiversity of the plants, you know, that the plant life that the animals are grazing on has a tremendous effect on the health of the animal and of the food that they produce. So there are lots of things to consider about how we're raising grazing animals, and both from an ecological standpoint and from a health of the animal and health of the food standpoint. But I think I'm glad these conversations are starting to happen now, because I don't think anyone was really focusing on this 20 years ago. Or, you know, let's put it this way. Very few people were talking about the importance of, you know, the soil biology and the biodiversity of the pasture or rangeland. But now we're realizing this isn't, you know, just a few hippies who want to live in the trees that are talking about this. I mean, this is really important stuff for having a truly ecologically sustainable food system.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I agree. The cover, and you get to some of that notion of the having complete cover is the sure fast way to reduce soil erosion. And that's been discussed plenty of times by plenty of people thinking about this over time. How do we, and one of the things, this is what I found really difficult in the literature. You talk about Alan Savory a little bit, and right, there's, that becomes a almost a dividing point for a lot of people that are kind of, we want to see the promise of regenerative agriculture and its principles, but are missing kind of the better sort of scientifically gathered evidence. And so one of the things that's really tough in the literature is kind of how people go about defining pasture versus rangeland, and what are these nuanced differences, how USDA defines them, how USGS defines them. Talk more, you brought up marginal lands. Talk to us about this concept, this important concept of marginal lands, and why they're so critical to the place or the role of the grazing animal.
Well, Dr. Lynn Hunsinger, who's retired now, but she was a great scientist at UC Berkeley in the biology department and a rangeland scientist for decades. She always says, you know, about half, almost half of the Earth's surface is not a place where you can raise crops. And, you know, it's either too hilly, it's too rocky, it's too windy, it's not warm enough. You know, there are lots of reasons why you can't raise crops in a lot of areas. And this is the place where the vast majority of the grazing of the world takes place. So this is a fundamental point that a lot of people don't understand. And, you know, they talk about, you know, again, going back to this idea of efficiencies, and, you know, we have, you know, we can raise soy on this amount of land and produce this many calories and this much protein. And there's a lot to be said about, you know, whether or not that's comparable to meat from the nutritional standpoint, but because it's not, but shorthand, it's not. But even just looking at it from an environmental efficiency argument, it doesn't make a lot of sense, because the vast majority of the grazing of the world's, you know, grazing animals is taking place on lands where you actually can't raise soy or any other crop like that. So the marginal lands, and, you know, this is especially true in the developing world where, you know, I actually attended a conference several years ago in Germany. I was a speaker at a conference that was a gathering of the world's, some of the world's smaller scale grazing peoples from around the world. And there were people from Argentina and Pakistan and Africa and lots of different parts of Africa, actually, at this event. And listening to them talk about the way grazing is practiced in their countries was so fascinating, because so many of these people are, they were kind of representing huge numbers of people who don't even own the land that they're grazing on, right? So they have herds of sheep, goats, cattle, camels even. And they're nomadic peoples, or they're people who have a small, you know, place where they live, but their animals are, they take them out every day to graze them on some land and then bring them back into some kind of enclosure in their small homestead. But they don't actually control very much land. But grazing allows that marginal land that can't be used for crop growth, and in many cases isn't even owned, you know, by someone who's doing agriculture with it. But it can be used for grazing. And of course, in the Western United States, we have a huge portion of the land here that is not suitable for crops. You know, I'm based in California, and I've traveled all over Oregon and much of California and Colorado and Utah, and seen a lot of this land for myself. And, you know, being originally from Michigan, it was not something I really understood until I moved to California. And you see the areas where the cattle are grazing, and you understand better for the first time that, you know, this is not a place where you could do, or maybe you really shouldn't be doing crop production. And so what this is doing is it's allowing that land that doesn't have the qualities that are required to be useful for crop production to be part of the food system. And because of what I was talking about earlier, the disappeared grazing animals that were once there, you know, whether they were elk or caribou or antelope or whatever, you know, and like I was amazed to learn in my research, you know, that on the land that we are on here in California, there were once 18 different types of megafauna in this very location that were grazing and were predators of these large grazing animals. So people think about the elk in California, but there were far more than elk. You know, there were different types of elephants. There were different types of lions. You know, there were bears, wolves. There was just an enormous kind of menagerie of large animals that once covered these landscapes. And when you're grazing cattle on these areas that are not suitable for farming, but they're sort of meant to be grasslands, you are providing some of the same kinds of impacts that those disappeared prehistoric animals would have been providing. And that allows those ecosystems to continue to exist. So all of the, you know, the raptors and, you know, and the snakes and the many, many other animals that live on these areas can continue to be here because you have the domesticated grazing animals now.
And as I hear you talk, I think more and more about this notion that the metric that we use really matters. You can frame your like or dislike around a certain production system based on a single metric, but what you argue and have several chapters on these different topics is that you have to think more holistically about the entire system. It's not just climate. It's not just greenhouse gases. It's not just water. It's not just land. It's not just biodiversity. Factoring in all of these points you to a particular system that is important. And I think you're driving home this notion of the importance of the grazing part of the system, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and just thinking in terms of the animal that you're raising, you know, and this would apply to other parts of the agricultural system as well. But when you're grazing animals for food, you're actually, you're interacting in sort of countless ways with nature, you know. And so the idea that you just sort of measure the inputs and the outputs, you know, and the production, and that's all you do, that to me is the whole problem with modern agriculture. And that's what's gotten us where we are today, where there are so many negative environmental impacts from the modern systems. What, you know, so I'm sort of saying we need to have a reset in the way that we just think about what we're doing and think about our starting points about how we want to do this. And so the issue doesn't become mitigation. You know, you're not trying to mitigate the negative effects of your system. You're trying to start from the beginning and say, what is the appropriate use of this land wherever you are? and how is this landscape meant to function, and what is best suited to be cultivated here or raised here, and then how do we raise it in such a way that it works with the natural resources that are present on this land. And that's what, you know, indigenous people have done all over the world for, you know, forever. But in modern agriculture, we've tended to kind of abandon that. We've basically felt we didn't need to, you know, pay attention to sort of the parameters, the natural parameters that existed there. And with respect to climate change, you know, I just think, I gave a talk at a fifth grade class a few weeks ago, and I started out with this little drawing where I had a cow, and I had like a whiteboard, and I had a cow that I drew, and then a car that I drew. And I said, what's the similarity between these two things? And I thought it, you know, it'd be interesting to see what the kids said, because a group of adults would probably say, well, they're both emitters, you know, of global warming gases, right? But a kid raised his hand and said, they both start with the letter C. And I said, exactly. That's exactly the right answer. Because the truth of the matter is that a car is a human-built machine that you can, in fact, very scientifically document every single sort of input and output, and the way, you know, that it is affecting not just the climate, but, you know, all of the environmental, you know, effects that you have from, you know, mining the ore for the steel. And, you know, you could go back and trace all of that. The cow is a totally different entity because it is a living, breathing organism that is going to be in a natural environment, and it's going to have countless, I mean, literally countless, kind of infinite interactions with its natural environment every day that it's alive. And so if you're just looking at inputs and outputs, it's kind of absurd. So what I'm arguing is we need to think about cattle as part of these, you know, these natural environments that have countless effects. And if we just focus on mitigating what we quote unquote mitigating negative impacts, it's kind of missing the whole point. Instead, we need to think of them as entities that belong on this earth, right? But they need to be managed in such a way that their impacts are beneficial. And when they are managed in a way that's comparable to the wild grazing animals, it will benefit the earth. It will benefit the water. It will benefit the vegetation, the biodiversity, the soils, and it will have few, if any, effects in terms of climate change.
So the mitigation conversation you just brought up is from kind of an external audience, but also in towards the latter part of the book, you start to note that there's some internal resistance to change that you call tone deafness. And that drives to some of these points that you say, kind of, you do see that there are issues, right? There's still some problems that you think need to be worked on, and would like to see them more openly discussed rather than resisted. And I'm going to list seven of them, and then you can talk about, you can pick and choose a couple to give us some more information about. But you list seven such problems that you'd love to see be a more open conversation in the industry and kind of make progress on. One being the way cattle are managed on the land, two, the substances they are fed, three, hormones and drugs that are used to stimulate growth, four, polluting practices, five, wasted resources, six, long distance transport of live animals, and then lastly, animal handling at slaughter. So let's talk about a couple of these issues that you say you'd like to see the industry make forward progress on.
Yeah, well, a couple of those relate to animal welfare. So the first point I want to make is I think the welfare situation of animals in the beef sector is probably by far the best, you know, as a general rule. Obviously, you can always find bad examples. But if you look at a life cycle and the life that a typical beef animal has, it's a pretty nice life, you know, and I think that's a very important starting point to make. But that being said, I think there are some significant animal welfare concerns that remain, especially with respect to, like, for example, transport of live animals, as you mentioned. You can transport cattle quite far in a relatively in a safe and high welfare situation, and it's fine. I don't suggest that, you know, there shouldn't be any transport of animals. But there are many examples where cattle are being transported. You know, those of us that are in the industry know that basically cattle cannot lie down when they're being transported, so because they risk being trampled to death. So they're basically standing that entire time. And groups like Animal Welfare Institute have come up with standards for the maximum length of transport. I'm not sure what it is off the top of my head. I think it's maybe 6 hours. I'm not sure. But essentially, we need to look at things like that and understand that those things are important, not just because the animals and their welfare is important, but because that's the kind of stuff that is giving, you know, the cattle industry a bad name. So we really need to understand that people care about that. And I think there's a dramatic difference now. When I started working on this 20 years ago, there was you know, concern about the welfare of animals in the food system, but it was mostly coming from, you know, what I would call kind of anti-meat activists. But now the mainstream consumer, I mean, this conversation has dramatically shifted over the last 20 years, and the mainstream consumer is talking about this. And so we, as, you know, a meat industry, need to be talking about this and understanding that it's important that the, you know, what the subjective experience of the animal is from birth all the way to slaughter is really important. We need to take it seriously. And there have been tremendous improvements made to, you know, the welfare of slaughter houses over the last, you know, obviously Temple Grandin has played a huge role in that, but there have been many other people as well. And so I think the industry has made dramatic improvements. And, you know, my husband, who's a, you know, really a meat industry guy, always says the welfare of the animal is incredibly important, not just for the sake of the animal, but because the meat quality suffers when you have, you know, poor animal handling at the slaughterhouse, especially, for example. So this is something we, you know, the meat industry has made improvements on, but needs to continue to work on a lot. I would say similarly, with respect to the use of growth hormones, you know, they were basically, they haven't been allowed for a long time in much of the world. The European Union and other countries around the world that have said you can't use these substances. And, you know, I think, you know, I encounter people all the time who talk about this, whether it's in milk or meat. And this is a concern for them. And I think, you know, if you do what they've done in Europe, where they basically say, well, nobody can use this, it levels the playing field. So then you don't just have some people using it and some people not using it. And then, you know, there's an advantage. I mean, you can get, of course, you can get meat cheaper to market if you're in milk as well. But what are the downstream effects? And I think one of the most important things is loss of consumer confidence. So if we together as an industry say we need to get rid of these things, I think that benefits everyone. And there are, you know, I think there's a lot of good evidence. I talk about some of it in the book about the reasons why we should be doing it just from the welfare of the animal standpoint, the health and welfare of the animal standpoint. But there's also some evidence suggesting that, it, you know, there's a problem for human health for some of these substances. So I think we need to take that seriously, and we should be doing everything possible to make consumers trust our food products that we're creating and want to consume them. So that's part of the reason I mentioned those issues.
Well, Nicolette, I appreciate it. We touched on only a small amount of the big items that you tackle in the book. And so there's plenty more to dive into that you discuss in the book, along with those kind of seven problems and how you see moving away from them as problems and kind of addressing them and moving the needle to a more kind of regenerative aspect, all show up in the text. And so we're going to close with one last question before we leave. And it's kind of what is piquing your interest now?
Well, I'm heartened. I mean, you know, I always feel kind of troubled whenever I see more and more talk about things like fake meat and, you know, replacing meat with these kinds of foods. Because I actually think that a cornerstone of a healthy diet is real food. And it's a lot of the reason I'm such a big defender of beef is because it's really nutrient rich food and provides so many valuable nutrients to humans. And I think humans, modern humans, are really nutrient deficient. So it's really important food. So I get troubled by the, you know, the kind of the idea that you can replace meat with fake food. But I'm also heartened, you know, and sort of what's given me optimism about this is there's more and more research, actual, you know, sort of scientific research showing the value of the foods from animals. And I'm excited to see this kind of emerging body of science showing that this is food that is unique and really valuable to human health. And Dr. Stephen Van Vliet and at Duke University, for example, is one of the people that is looking at a kind of microscopic level about the different types of things that are offered in these different foods and showing that there's no real equivalence between meat and fake meat. And I think this is going to strengthen the argument that we should be focusing on, you know, again, it's not the cow, it's the how. Because when we raise animals well, they are environmentally beneficial and they provide extremely valuable food for humans. And so to me, that's the question. That is the crux of the matter. How are we raising the animals? Not should we or should we not? To me, that's very clear. But how? And if we can all kind of agree, you know, people that are raising animals and people that are just consuming them or not consuming them, you know, if we can all kind of agree that there's an urgent question there and focus our resources and attention there, then I think we can make a lot of progress.
Well, Nicolette, thank you for joining us and leaving us with kind of wrestling with thinking about and trying to answer the how question.
Yes. Well, thank you for inviting me.